Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Every American is going to see where every senator stands on protecting one of the most important rights a woman has.
As the U.S. Senate takes a vote on abortion, we look at where the battle over reproductive rights is headed. Then...
Vous êtes enceinte, mademoiselle. Je suis désolé.
C'est pas possible.
Happening, the groundbreaking film just opened in America about a woman seeking an abortion in 1960s France. I speak to its director, Audrey Diwan, also ahead.
I'm against natal.
I'm still undecided. Also undecided.
I guess I'm for natal.
And I'm a bit ambiguous on the question still.
What Finland's young people feel as their country mulls joining NATO. Plus,
now the Supreme Court is coming in and rolling things back. And the question is whether there's now going to be an awakening on the left.
How the U.S. Supreme Court could transform America as we know it. Hari Srinivasan speaks with author and law professor Rick Harson.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The U.S. Senate is voting today on a measure that would codify Roe v.ersus Wade, guaranteeing a woman's right to abortion. Democratic leadership is strongly backing its passage, but doesn't really expect it to get close to the filibuster-proof 60 votes required. The purpose, therefore, is more symbolic, shining a spotlight on which senators and which parties are for and against abortion rights. The vote was rushed into action after the draft opinion from the Supreme Court leaked last week, which revealed a complete overturning of the 1973 precedent established by Roe v.ersus Wade. Joining me now to discuss where this all leads is Alexa Colby Molinas. She's deputy director of the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project, and she's recently argued this issue before the Supreme Court. So, Alexa Colby Molinas, thanks for joining us from New York. Where do you see this very divisive issue leading? If you had a gut, I guess right now, do you think that draft will in fact be the opinion that's handed down, I think next month?
Well, look, if I knew the answer to that question, I certainly would be a lot easier for me to sleep at night. But what we do know is that the draft opinion that we saw last week just confirms our deepest fears, which is that there are at least 5 votes on the Supreme Court who do seem ready to take away our ability to control our bodies, our lives, and our futures, and to criminalize people for seeking and providing essential health care.
So we mentioned that you had argued a case on this issue a few months ago before the Supreme Court. Just if you can, without going into all the details, what was the atmosphere? What was the result? Did you see it, you know, heading towards where we are now?
So the decision and the case that I was arguing was actually about a procedural issue. So it didn't really go to the heart of the right to abortion the way that the Mississippi decision that, you know, we saw in the leak opinion last week. So it wasn't really a good, I think, measure of what we've seen. But we do know that with all of these decisions, whether it's the case that I argued from Kentucky in October, or the decision we saw in December around Texas, where the Supreme Court has already given the green light to a state to ban abortion. And we've seen the devastation that that has caused. So we have seen where this is going, and we have been preparing for this for a while. And as I said, it was a gut punch to see that leaked opinion last week, but it wasn't a surprise. It really was just confirming our deepest fears.
So let's just put a little bit of a mashup of what some of the justices have said about this issue when it was being argued and debated in December.
But if it really is an issue about choice, why is 15 weeks not enough time?
The fetus has an interest in having a life, and that doesn't change, does it, from the point before viability to the point after viability?
The reason this issue's hard is that you can't accommodate both interests. You have to pick. That's the fundamental problem.
So, Alexa, and then Justice Amy Coney Barrett, she basically was talking about why should there be a need for abortion rights if, in fact, there are these safe haven laws for children to be dropped off and adopted and the like. And we had Kavanaugh also saying that, you know, forget about precedent. It doesn't really matter if a majority disagrees with these precedents. So, again, talk to us about the law and how you think it's going to manifest when it gets out of the federal and into the states.
Well, I mean, and the thing about Justice Barrett's arguments and about so many of these arguments, whether it's some of the ones that you played just now or Alito's claim in the draft opinion that other rights won't be affected, they're just all in bad faith. No one should be forced to continue a pregnancy to term against their will and bear the life-altering consequences of doing so. And it's really important to remember that in the United States, we are facing a maternal mortality crisis. And it is no coincidence that the states that will be first out of the block to ban abortion, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, are the same ones that have abysmal rates of maternal mortality and morbidity, and which really disproportionately affect Black women. So the impact of what this decision could have really can't be underestimated. It really can't be understated.
Can I ask you, Alexa, because obviously you take a particular view. You're the ACLU and you argue these cases on very specific grounds and with very specific aims and goals. And clearly you believe, and I guess the ACLU and Americans who support Roe versus Wade, that the existing parameters are the ones that should continue to be allowed. Can I read you some of the latest polling on this and ask you whether you think there is any room for maybe some adjustments? So the Pew Research Center, while continuing to say that the majority of Americans oppose overturning Roe versus Wade, they now say in further questions, only 19% support abortion being legal in all cases. 42% want it to be legal in most cases, but would accept some instances where it would be illegal. Then 8% want it to be illegal all the time. 29% want it to be illegal in most cases, but would accept some circumstances where it would be legal. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there are nuances. Do you think this moment, when it goes back to the states, if indeed it does, will appreciate those nuances or not? Or will, what do you think will happen?
No, I think we know that about half the states will move to make abortion illegal if Roe v. Wade is overturned. And that is going to affect nearly 36 million people who can become pregnant. So the devastation is going to be widespread. The nightmare that we see in Texas is going to become a reality for millions of people. And really what we are talking about here, we are talking about something so core as the ability to control our body, our life, to make decisions about our futures. Something like that simply cannot be set, just sent to a popular vote. Something that is such a fundamental right and that is so core to our being and our dignity as humans simply just can't be left to a referendum. And that's why the devastation of removing this constitutional protection and of overturning Roe v. Wade would be so widespread.
So in a country that is already very, very divided, not just along, you know, along the lines of Roe versus Wade, but on everything, and we've seen it just sort of increase over the last few years, right down to, you know, whether Democrats and Republicans, you know, agree that there can be intermarriage, so to speak, where people live, all of these things have become crazy partisan. So in the issue of Roe versus Wade being overturned, if it is, we're already seeing governors in red and blue states already taking actions, like Gavin Newsom of California has said that he wants to change his state constitution to protect abortion rights, whereas immediately last week, the Oklahoma governor signed a law banning abortion after 6 weeks. When you look out, how do you visualize the map of America, the populations of America, divided down this issue? What will it look like? What will happen?
I mean, what we are going to see is a place where, is a country where your ability to decide to make these decisions about your body and your life is going to depend on your zip code. And that's the world we had in this country prior to Roe. But the scary thing is that anti-abortion politicians are not going to stop with state bans. There are already politicians in Congress plotting to pass a federal nationwide ban. And we need only look to other countries, like, for example, El Salvador, to see that the devastation of what a nationwide abortion ban would cause. And this country has never seen something like that. And what I think a lot of people don't realize is that when abortion is illegal, every pregnancy loss can be investigated as evidence of a crime. And that will turn people, especially if we are talking about a nationwide ban, anyone experiencing pregnancy loss into a criminal suspect. And people who experienced this country before Roe v. Wade knew what that was like. But then to imagine that on a national scale, I think is harrowing.
Can you give us an idea, just for viewers and Americans to understand and around the world, what actually is the result of a country like El Salvador banning, having a national ban?
Well, I mean, I think there was an article recently, and there have been certainly articles in the New York Times and other papers over the years about women serving sentences of decades, life, simply for experiencing pregnancy loss and being accused of illegally having an abortion. It's not just going to affect people who seek and try to have abortions if abortion is going to be illegal. It's going to affect anybody who can become pregnant, anyone who can experience pregnancy loss. The threat of criminalization and incarceration is going to be hanging over everyone's head. And again, people who experienced this country prior to Roe v. Wade, especially doctors, they remember what that was like. They knew what it was like with police coming to the hospital, investigating women who are experiencing miscarriage. And that's a very frightening situation to return to.
And you mentioned miscarriage, but also IVF. Suddenly doctors are talking about that. That is becoming, you know, an area of investigation and interest to see whether even those issues might fall under any further restrictive laws. What do you think about that?
Well, look, this decision, if indeed we see an opinion like the leaked opinion, the impact is not going to stop with abortion. Because when we're talking about this interconnected framework of our rights, Roe v. Wade is a load-bearing element. It's going to be about IVF. It's going to be about birth control, the right to marry who we love, the right to gender-affirming care. All of those rights are going to be at risk if something like the leaked opinion is indeed what the final opinion in this case is like. And, you know, we have never seen the Supreme Court take away a constitutional right, let alone a right that is so core to our ability to control our bodies and our lives and our futures, and one that has existed for nearly 50 years. for the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade is not just unprecedented because they've never done something like that, but it's unprecedented because it would upend the very meaning of legal precedent. So there is no reason to think that this would stop with the right to abortion and would not affect other fundamental rights that we hold very dear.
So let me just dig into that issue a little bit more with you and read what the president of GLAAD has said. None of us are safe from the extreme anti-women, anti-LGBTQ ideology that now dominates this court. So going back to what you said and what many activists and human rights and many women, of course, have raised the fear that many other established law, for instance, same-sex marriage, interracial marriage, same-sex sex, all of that could be at risk, despite what Justice Alito has said. So he said, to ensure that our decision is not misunderstood or mischaracterized, we emphasize that our decision concerns the constitutional right to abortion and no other right. Nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion. Why do you doubt what he's saying? It's very clear what he said.
Because the Supreme Court has never done what that opinion threatens to do, which is take away an established fundamental right. And there is absolutely nothing to stop the Supreme Court from coming back a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, and doing that with other fundamental rights. I just don't think those words are worth the paper they're written on.
And can I just talk also about the Constitution? These justices who have signed on to this draft law, or draft opinion rather, they basically dismissed the idea that anything regarding abortion was ever mentioned in the Constitution. There's an obvious answer to that. Women weren't mentioned in the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. But they are also not agreeing with your side, who takes the 14th Amendment and basically, you know, includes all these things we've just been talking about into the right to personal liberty. How does one get past that? Because it's really just opinion, isn't it?
Well, that's how legal decisions work. And I think what's important here is that we have had, especially with the right to abortion, a settled understanding of the law, an understanding that people have relied on and formed their lives around for nearly 50 years. And to take that away is just to, you know, to suggest that it's just a matter of academic debate, I think is to really diminish the impact of eliminating and removing fundamental rights has on people's lives. And so I think we just have to think about it far more broadly than simply just an academic debate. The fact is, this is established law, and for the Supreme Court to take it away would be unprecedented and devastating.
So, Alexa, I want to ask you about the political movement that has brought, you know, this to bear. In other words, the Federalist Society and all of the others who are connected with them, who lay down markers for who and how they will support presidential and other candidates, and Roe v. Wade always being the benchmark. And I assume you agree that they've been successful politically. Trump came, named three to the Supreme Court who've appended their names to this opinion. And I spoke to the president of the Judicial Crisis Network, Carrie Severino. This is what she said. And of course, they use quite inflammatory language. And I want to ask you about that. Listen to what she said.
What's good about this is it's going to return that decision to the people themselves, who can then come to those political compromises and not be forced into a one-size-fits-all regime for the nation that is, in fact, far more liberal than what the country would like to see. I think that means that some states seem to be pushing the envelope even farther. Some seem to be suggesting that even post-birth fetal demise should not be prosecuted. That's pretty extreme. 9 months alone isn't enough.
So can you react? I mean, I reacted with astonishment and alarm at what she said. Post-birth, 9 months is not enough. I mean, we know that the data shows that 92% of American abortions are in the first trimester. So react to that language.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it was inflammatory. I mean, that rhetoric, it's false, it's misleading, it's not based on science or fact. And what its real purpose is to perpetuate lies about people who have abortions and the people who care for them. That's all it is.
Alexa Colby Molinas, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Next, a new French film has just opened in the United States, and it is taking a bracing look at the realities of life before abortion was legal. It's called Happening. It follows a young student in 1960s France seeking the procedure, and the camera does not shy away from the huge risks that women went through at that time. Here's a look at the trailer.
Mais qu'est-ce que t'as? T'as pas le comme tout? Pas nous faire une maladie maintenant.
Vous êtes enceinte, mademoiselle. Je suis désolé.
C'est pas possible. Faites quelque chose.
Vous ne pouvez pas me demander ça. Toute personne qui vous aiderait risque de finir en prison et vous avec.
So the film is receiving very high praise and rave reviews. It won the top prize at the Venice Film Festival. Its director and co-writer, Audrey Diwan, joins me now. Welcome to the program from Paris. Let me just ask you initially for your reaction to the fact that it's opening in the United States right slap bang in the middle of this extremely divisive political crisis for many people in the U.S. What did you think about the fact that it landed there, your film, at this time?
I'm amazed because, you know, when I wrote the movie, I heard a lot of the question, like, why would you make a movie about illegal abortion now? I mean, in France, we have the law, we're protected by the law since 1975. But I had in mind from the very beginning that it's always a topic in some countries in the world, lots of countries, but I would have never imagined that it could be America.
Audrey Diwan, just give me a synopsis of what your story is about and what it was based on.
It's based on a book. It's a true story of a writer called Annie Ernaux, a very good writer. And I wanted the movie to be an experience. What if we're not looking at Anne, the character, but let's try to be her, like viscerally try to be this girl for an hour and a half. And it's not about a girl making a decision whether she should or not have an abortion, illegal abortion. She already had made her decision, and it's only the journey. It's how she managed to go through that journey in order to be free, like in many ways, because we talk about this young girl who actually has sexual desire, but also intellectual desire. She comes from a working class. She's the first generation going to university. And one day she wants to be a writer. And it's her journey to that kind of freedom, you know?
And again, it's set in the 60s before abortion became legal in France. I want to play a little clip. And this is where she's talking to another young girl who is steering her to somebody who can help her get a back alley illegal abortion. Here's this clip.
Elle a de l'expérience. C'est un avantage. Souris, s'il te plaît. Et puis c'est propre. Elle fait bouillir tous ses instruments.
Ça fait mal?
Oui. Tout le temps que ça dure. Essaie de penser à autre chose. La douleur, ça passe. Moi, au moins, j'ai pas fini à l'hôpital. Là-bas, c'est la loterie. Soit t'as de la chance et tu tombes sur un médecin qui te classe en fausse couche, soit tu tombes sur un salaud qui écrit avortement sur ton dossier. Et là, si tu meurs pas, et ben tu finis en prison.
And so, Audrey, the stakes are really, really high, of course, leading even to prison potentially, if she got, or any woman at that time, was discovered to have had an abortion. Go back to what it was like when you tried to make the film today, because it wasn't obvious. You said that you were asked why. Was it easy to get funding, to get support? How did you actually get to do it?
I'm lucky because my producers are fighters. It was very hard to make the movie and to find the money. You know, we were raised being silent on that topic, and the society prefers not to hear about those stories. And for instance, Annie Ernaux, the writer, told me from the very beginning that from all her book, this is the only one who get no mediatic attention. So she warned me and say, this is going to be your war. If you want to tell this truth, if you do it like me, if you don't look away, if you want to tell the whole truth that nobody exactly wants to look at, then you have to fight hard. And that's what we did, because we had not much money to make the movie, and a very pretty much involved crew, actresses and all the crew. And it happened because everybody wanted to tell the story for a purpose, for a meaning, you know.
You know, one of the things I was fascinated about in interviews that you've done and also in reviews of the film and talking to people who've come out of the film, many of the articles focus on men's reaction, men who've seen your film. And certainly many of them said, at least some of them said, and I'll quote, that it was like being a woman for an hour and a half. They spoke of feeling physical pain, and one, apparently some men almost fainted or did faint. What is your reaction to men's reaction to your film?
I love the idea of sharing. I mean, I wrote the movie expecting that I could make it beyond gender, beyond age, beyond culture, you know. Let's share an experience. I mean, it's the magic of art. It's the magic of movies. You know, we can actually share experiences that are not ours. And actually, in many times in my life, I changed my mind thanks to movies, you know. So, yes, of course, I met men who actually told me about having the body of a woman, you know. And then I also talked to men and women who were against abortion, and we actually managed to talk. And I think that's what we need now. I mean, we need discussion. And, you know, it's very interesting because in the book, as in the movie, the word abortion is never said because we were raised not saying those things. And at some point, we need to say that. I mean, through the process of my movie, I said, when I had an abortion, but before working on it, I wouldn't dare doing it. And words are actually the other weapon. We have to fight against silence in order to recreate this discussion that is so urgently needed today.
You raise the issue of taboo, a taboo that still exists around the discussion. I do think it's amazing what you said about the people who you talk to, both pro-choice and anti-abortion, and you said you could actually have a discussion. And I do think that's really important. But it still is a bit of a taboo in a country where it does not seem, well, it's certainly not a political issue like in the United States, and it does seem like it's settled law. Is it still taboo to talk about this? And do French women or others fear that even in France, the right to choose is at risk or may one day be at risk?
I mean, we've seen what happened in so many other countries in the world, you know, the Poland recently. I mean, we all sadly know that, yeah, we have the law on our side now. But come on, I mean, 10 days ago was election time in France, and we were very close from having the extreme right side winning the election. And then who knows, you know, I always have the feeling that it's a very fragile law and that we have to keep in mind that it could change. And I mean, there is nothing else to say that to me, anyone who wants to involve himself in this debate should at least know what is the journey of illegal abortion. I mean, reading the book, I literally felt that I was in a very intimate thriller. I couldn't stop reading it because I needed to know what was happening to this girl. And I realized that I talked many times about abortion, and I gave my opinion in debates not knowing what it was exactly like. As human beings, do we agree on that level of pain, of that level of loneliness? Because we know that when abortion goes illegal, that's the way it is. So at least we shouldn't close our eyes and look away, you know.
And can you describe a little bit one of the main actresses in the film, who I believe is the one who provides the abortion? you really manage that with the gestures, with the way I've read about how you asked her to perform that role for you in the film was incredibly affecting. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, I mean, Anna Mouglalis, the actress, has the young Anna Maria Bartolome, my young actress, in this sequence. And it's a very long shot. I mean, I don't cut much because my idea is that if you keep rolling for a while, then the feelings are not theoretical. Then you feel what she feels. I mean, if I ask Anna Maria to show that she's in pain, the audience gets it. But if we keep doing it that way, if she managed to do it, the actresses, then we will feel what she feels. And by the way, we were very careful because if we go too far that way, then right. We become provocative, and that was not the idea. But talking about that special sequence, you know, it was very hard to know what are the exact gesture. And I learned through my research that if the gesture is not done properly, like 1 millimeter, then the girl's going to die. So it's a very intimate and strange moment in between two women that don't know each other. But also it was so hard to have some information on how to process that we needed to ask the Science Museum and to get information from very precise, the university helped us also because nobody knows. And I realized even more that there is a lack of representation because trying to make the movie, I couldn't find the exact way to do it. So it gave me even more strength or will to do it.
Audrey Diwan, thank you so much indeed. The film Happening. And next to international geopolitics, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is in Scandinavia today, signing security pacts with Sweden and Finland, pledging military support if the nations come under attack during a NATO bid period. The United States has made similar assurances. Now, this all comes as Finland and Sweden near a decision on joining NATO. The Kremlin spokesman says they are closely studying this in Moscow. This move is very close to their border, as he said. Now, in this report, Nick Robertson asked the Finnish students he met how they feel about changing their country's so-called neutral status.
As Finland's parliament discusses at pace the historic step of potentially joining NATO, the speed of debate has some young Finns worrying their generation will be hurt by a decision taken in haste through fear of Putin that they have little say in. Five students at the University of Helsinki agreed to tell us their views.
I'm against NATO.
I'm still undecided. Also undecided.
I guess I'm for NATO.
And I'm a bit ambiguous on the question still.
You're against NATO?
Yeah.
Why?
It's a military alliance led by a superpower that has waged horrendous wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I understand people being very afraid of Russia and what they're doing. Horrible, horrible things. But it's kind of like fighting the wolf by teaming up with the bear. Like, the bear isn't great either.
If at this moment we take this stance towards the whole of Russia, what does it mean in a situation where hopefully the regime changes at some point to a more positive direction?
And you're undecided.
Yes.
What's the pros and cons?
I also get the arguments for safety, and that's why I'm still undecided.
I think we are currently as a society very emotionally charged, and that is why I'm inclined to sort of say that perhaps now is not the greatest time to make such a huge decision.
We are like a sovereign democratic country, mm-hmm. and I don't want those kind of fears to impact our decision making.
But I think waiting too long is the more dangerous. It's not as dangerous right now to start this process as it would be in, let's say, 2 years from now.
What's the public debate that's going on?
In my social media bubble, it's very kind of pro-NATO.
And it kind of does feel like on social media, it seems like if you are anti-Russia, you are automatically pro-NATO.
I feel like a lot of people are making a lot of assumptions about what Putin is thinking. Personally, I have yet to see evidence of him wanting to invade Finland.
What do you think the consequences of this decision are going to be?
If and when we join NATO, and if we are admitted to NATO, what kind of relationship will we have with Russia? And that's the big question to me, at least, that you know, the geography is always there.
Finnish students sharing their thoughts with Nick Robertson. And coming up tomorrow, we'll take a closer look at this issue with the former prime ministers, Alexander Stubb of Finland and Carl Bildt of Sweden. Returning now to the US Supreme Court and Roe versus Wade. If overturned, it'll be a political, legal and cultural blast wave, as we've been discussing. But there are a number of cases before the court that our next guest says will, quote, reorder law and American society. Richard Husson is a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, and an expert in election law. He's also the author of Cheap Speech, and he tells Hari Srinivasan how to cure the disinformation that poisons politics.
Christian, thanks. Professor Rick Husson, thanks so much for joining us. Last month, you wrote, and I want to quote here, "I don't think most Americans appreciate how much the Supreme Court is going to reorder law and American society in the next 15 months. That is, by the end of the term next year in June. Guns, abortion, affirmative action is just the start." Well, we got a teaser, so to speak, of the leaked draft when it comes to abortion. What are the other big cases that you are watching?
Well, the court's going to decide about whether people have a constitutional right to carry guns outside the home, which could upset a number of gun control laws in cities and states across the United States. Not this term, but next term, meaning a decision by a year from June, the court's going to decide a couple of affirmative action cases, one out of Harvard, one out of the University of North Carolina, which could end the use of race-based affirmative action in education. The court also is considering a major case this term involving the Environmental Protection Agency. And what's at issue there is the power of executive agencies to be able to carry on dealing with problems like climate change without, you know, very explicit authorization from Congress. So it could kind of weaken the power of agencies. And then in my own area, there are a couple of voting cases that are coming down, not the end of this term, but the end of next term. One which could severely limit the reach of the Voting Rights Act as applied to redistricting, and another one that could upset the balance between state courts and state legislatures over setting federal election rules. And that's just a start.
You wrote recently in a Harvard Law Review, and you had several different concerns that you were kind of looking at. And one of them was about basically someone's vote for president being almost structurally overturned, and who administers the counting of those votes, and whether something could prevent what we consider our vehicle to impose our will on democracy.
So this is something I never expected to worry about in the United States, the risk that we could have election subversion, that the person who gets the most votes won't be declared the winner of the election. And this has become a real risk. One of the things that we saw in the aftermath of the 2020 U.S. presidential election is that so much of our rules for determining who the president is require people to act in good faith rather than just very strict legal rules. So, for example, in Michigan, a board of two Democrats and two Republicans has to certify that the winner of the election is actually the winner. And there was great pressure on the Republican certifiers not to do so. One abstained. The other one has been since been removed from this position. So there's a lot of places in between the time that voters vote and the time that Congress on January 6th finally determines who the winner is, where people can try to mess with the system. And so we know that Donald Trump tried to interfere. We know that he contacted over 30 different election and elected officials in the period after Election Day, before January 6, 2021, trying to manipulate those results. And I'm afraid that that's going to happen again in the next presidential election, where we won't have those heroic Republican and Democratic election and elected officials to stand up to Trump and say, we're going to follow the rule of law.
So that is really something that is a consequence of what could happen during the midterms. I mean, the people who are elected into those positions to be the Secretary of State or the certifier at the local level. Is that your concern here, that could impact the 2024 presidential election?
Absolutely. So let's just take one example. You may remember the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger. He's the one that stood up to Trump, recorded the phone call where Trump wanted Raffensperger to so-called find 11,780 votes. Well, Raffensperger is facing a primary later this month in Georgia, where one of his chief opponents is a Republican congressman named Jody Heiss, who's one of the people who's embraced the so-called Stop the Steal movement, who's embraced the big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. He could be the one running elections in Georgia in 2024, even if he runs the election fairly. Imagine it's Trump versus Biden, too. And he says Trump's won the election. Are Democrats and people on the left going to even believe him? And so some of the crisis in confidence that we've seen on the right over election integrity, ginned up by the false claims that Donald Trump made in 2020, we're going to see that mirrored, I think, in some places on the left, because some of the election deniers, the ones that said that the 2020 election wasn't fair, are going to be the ones actually running the election in 2024.
As you mentioned, there's a voting rights case coming from Alabama that looks at Section 2. Why is that important, and what is at stake there?
Right. So back in 2013, in Shelby County versus Holder, the Supreme Court struck down that part of the Voting Rights Act that had been in place since 1965 that required jurisdictions with a history of race discrimination in voting to get federal approval before they could make changes in their voting laws and demonstrate that those laws wouldn't make minority voters worse off. Mm-hmm. And we were told when the Supreme Court decided that case, don't worry, there's always Section 2. Section 2 is the part of the Voting Rights Act that says that minority voters should have the same opportunities as others to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. Well, one shoe fell last summer in a case called Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee. That was a case where the Supreme Court read Section 2 very narrowly in outside the context of redistricting in the case of laws that make it harder to register or to vote. And now the other shoe is going to drop, likely, in this case out of Alabama. A three-judge court made up of two Trump appointees, applying current Supreme Court precedent, said that Alabama had to draw a second Black majority district because that group was large enough and geographically located close enough to each other that they could actually create a district where they'd be able to elect a candidate of their choice against the kind of racially polarized voting that we see in Alabama. Well, the Supreme Court put that second district on hold. Chief Justice Roberts, who's no fan of the Voting Rights Act, dissented there, saying, let's have a full hearing. The lower court applied the correct law. But Roberts agreed with the majority that we need to rethink this whole thing. And the upshot is that it's going to be much harder for minority voters to be able to sue and get districts drawn in order to be able to get a fair share of political power if the Supreme Court now takes Section 2 and does do it in the redistricting context what it did outside the redistricting context last summer.
If the political climate is so divided that we have the possibility of our votes being overturned in a structural way by people who are elected who believe that there's a different winner, and if we see these attacks on the Voting Rights Act succeed, I mean, is it fair to think that this is almost parallel to what happened in Reconstruction? I mean, these seem like pretty big threats to democracy here.
They are big threats to democracy. But I don't want to leave your viewers with the idea that all hope is lost. So on the Voting Rights Act, for example, Congress, if it had the political will and if there were large enough majorities, could actually change the Voting Rights Act and make it clear that what the Supreme Court's doing, because the Supreme Court, when it's interpreting what Section 2 means, is not making a constitutional ruling like it did back in 2013 on Section 5. So Congress can come back and strengthen voting protections. Democrats have been trying to get voting protections through for many months now, so far unsuccessfully. It's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem because as it gets harder to vote, it's harder to elect the majorities who are actually going to support voting rights. But when you think about how voting rights expanded in this country, it's only in recent decades that we relied on the courts to be able to strengthen voting rights in many ways, it was a political movement, right? The 15th Amendment says after the Civil War, no discrimination in voting on the basis of race. The 19th Amendment says no discrimination on the basis of gender in voting, right? That's about 100 years ago that women got the constitutional right. That was a political struggle. The Supreme Court refused earlier to say that women were enfranchised by other parts of the Constitution. So this is going to have to be a political struggle. It's going to be a difficult political struggle because these voting rules make it harder to get the kind of majorities that you need to change voting legislation. But, you know, I don't think this is a time to give up. This is time to double down on political action to try to protect voting rights.
I wonder if part of the language that Justice Alito used in this leaked draft was hinting at the fact that, or not even hinting, is explicitly saying that times have changed. And I wonder if that same line of reasoning could be used to roll back lots of these sort of gains in terms of voting rights.
Right, but that, you know, that assumes that you have a fair voting process. And if you don't have a fair voting process, the Supreme Court, in a very old case called Yick Woe versus Hopkins, said that voting rights are among the most important rights because they're preservative of all other rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't have the ability to vote, you know, you're not going to have the same kind of clout to be protected in the political process. You know, one question that's going to arise politically, if the Supreme Court actually issues an opinion that looks like the Justice Alito opinion, what kind of political backlash will this create? Will people be concerned enough about the loss of abortion rights and what it potentially means for the loss of same-sex marriage rights, new limits on contraception, potentially even opening up the ability of states to ban interracial marriage? I mean, there's all kinds of things that would be on the table if the Supreme Court issues an opinion like the one that was leaked, the draft opinion. What kind of political backlash will that create? That's what we don't know. One of the things we've seen is that over the last 4 to 5 decades, the right has been much more focused on the Supreme Court's role in society than the left. I think that's because in the Warren Court in the 1960s, there were a lot of decisions that liberalized things. Now the Supreme Court is coming in and rolling things back. And the question is whether there's now going to be an awakening on the left about the role of the Supreme Court in society and how much in our country we delegate decisions about fundamental questions to this, you know, group of unelected, not 9-member, life tenured body of judges. When Amy Coney Barrett came onto the court a couple of years ago, she was 48. If she lives as long as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, she'll be on the court for another 40 years. I mean, that it's a long time to give someone power over these kinds of questions. And we'll see politically what this means if, in fact, the Supreme Court is out of step with where a good part of American society is.
You have a recent book out. It's titled Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. First of all, what's cheap speech?
So that term actually goes back to a 1995 Law Review article that a professor at UCLA named Eugene Volokh wrote. He was talking about the upcoming information revolution and saw that it was going to be much easier for people to share information and get information, right? We have the knowledge of the world's in the palm of our hands. It was a very positive view. That's one meaning of cheap speech, but the other meaning of cheap speech, and I mean both of them in my book, is that we have a system where lower valued speech, like false statements, misinformation about vaccines or elections or whatever, is much easier to spread and has an advantage in the information marketplace than higher valued speech. It's still very expensive to do good investigative journalism, for example. But the economic model that supported journalists, that supported local newspapers, has collapsed as advertising has moved to Facebook and Google. And so you have a situation where the markets for information is kind of failing, and it makes it much harder for voters to get accurate information about what's going on. And Exhibit A, and where I start my book, Cheap Speech, is by talking about the January 6th insurrection and the millions of people who believe the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen. I think if we had the politics of today, but the technology of the 1950s, it would have been very hard for this lie to have spread. I mean, think about the fact that Donald Trump was able to go to Twitter 400 times between Election Day and November 19th, 2020, and spread the false claim directly without fact-checking, without any limit on his repetition, the false claim that the election was stolen. And so the question is, how do you have a democracy that is committed to both robust free speech in elections and also fair elections where voters get accurate information? That's really one of the key democratic dilemmas of our time.
All right. So that opens me up to say, what's your advice then for the richest man in the world who is in the process of trying to buy a digital town square called Twitter? How does he strike that balance?
Well, what he's been saying is that he's going to look to the First Amendment as the limitation of what kind of speech should be on Twitter. And I think he's going to be in for a rude awakening, at least if he's going to try and make money with Twitter. And given the billions that he and his allies are investing, I think they're probably going to want to make money. But, you know, if there were no content moderation and anything could be put on these platforms, it would be filled with pornography, with hate speech, with spam ads for things. We wouldn't want that, right? So I'm not talking about what the government requires. I'm just talking about as consumers, we value good content moderation because that is what tells us. Just like the New York Times doesn't print everything possible, PBS doesn't just put on the air anything, it curates, right? And so I think he's not going to be able to have an unmoderated system. I think he's going to be focused mostly on the question of political speech. And there, I don't think Facebook and Twitter should be replatforming Donald Trump because he continues to be a threat to American democracy by undermining people's legitimacy in the process of running fair elections. And by the fact that he didn't condemn the violence of January 6, 2021, which was one of the most serious threats American democracy has faced in its entire history.
What kind of incentives can we create, either as consumers or any kind of legislative way, for the tech companies to change the way they amplify information?
I don't know that there's too much that can be done. It's not the kind of thing that you can shut down because, you know, we don't have good mechanisms to be able to decide who gets to speak and who doesn't get to speak. So I think just like the New York Times or Fox News gets to decide what content is on the air, it's the same thing with these platforms. But that doesn't mean they're immune from public pressure. I mean, I think there's a reason why Twitter and Facebook decided to deplatform Donald Trump after the violent events of January 6th, 2021. And I think one of the key levers here are the employees who work for these tech companies. These engineers and other people are very much in demand. They're not going to stand for a system that's going to undermine democracy. And so while I think consumers have some pressure that they can put on these companies, because these companies are very large and they're not that subject to pressure, it's the employees that could serve as an important tool to be able to assure that we have some moderation of content that is dangerous to our democracy.
Professor Rick Hassan from the University of California, Irvine, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been wonderful to talk to you.
And just a note, after that conversation was recorded, Elon Musk announced that he would reverse Twitter's ban on Donald Trump. And finally tonight, let's take a moment to pay tribute to Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who's been shot and killed while reporting in the occupied West Bank, despite wearing a jacket clearly identifying her as a member of the press. The crowds mourning her death are evidence of the respect that she had from viewers and from colleagues. She was beloved by many Palestinians for her compassionate reporting on their lives. Joining Al Jazeera at the age of 26, Abu Akleh spent over 20 years at the network, and not long ago, she spoke about what being a journalist meant to her.
It may not be easy to change reality, but at least I've been able to share that Palestinian voice to the world. I am Shireen Abu Akleh.
Al Jazeera producer was also wounded, but he's in a stable condition. Now, even in death, however, there is still dispute. Al Jazeera says that Shireen was shot by Israeli forces in that occupied territory. The IDF says it is not possible to determine yet which direction she was shot from. They've launched an inquiry. That's it for now. And if you ever miss our show, you can find the latest episode shortly after it airs on our podcast. On your screen now is a QR code, and all you need to do is pick up your phone and scan it with your camera. You can also find it at cnn.com/podcast and on all major platforms. Just search Amanpour. And remember, you can always catch us online on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.